Chefs Without Restaurants, episode 65 with Brendan Hudson.
Two things that we've really kind of been able to focus on with all of the time that we had to kind of adjust. These virtual cooking classes have been great. I mean, it's great because you can have as many or as little guests as you want. Whereas with in-person cooking classes, sometimes that's limited because of space or ingredients or, you know, whatever it is. And then the other thing I think that has been great is that we've really been able to focus on our digital presence through all of this and really focusing on doing, you know, really nice food photography and upping our, just our general kind of presence online, because we've realized that, especially now, your digital presence to somebody, your Instagram profile, your Facebook, your website, whatever it is somebody's first impression of your business.
This is the Chefs Without Restaurants podcast with your host, Chris Spear. Each week, I'll be speaking with food entrepreneurs and people in the culinary industry. If you're interested in learning more about our organization dedicated to helping people build and grow their food businesses, look us up on the web at chefswithoutrestaurants.com and .org, and on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Chefs Without Restaurants. Now, enjoy the show. On the podcast this week, I have Chef Brendan Hudson. He's the owner and chef of Liliana Catering Company. Brendan was recently voted Best Chef by Baltimore Magazine's Reader's Poll. We discuss the state of catering and the personal chef business, the rise of the micro wedding, the thumbtack platform, and so much more. I really hope you enjoy this episode. Thanks for listening, and have a great week. Welcome, everyone. This is Chris with the Chefs Without Restaurants podcast. And on today's show, I have Chef Brendan Hudson, owner and chef of Liliana Catering. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chris. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Did you have a good weekend? Did you have to work?
Yes. So actually, thankfully, I had to work. Yes. We had, so the catering company obviously was quite a bit slow for a while, but now we're starting to pick up, you know, doing some micro weddings and more like smaller private intimate events.
I find the micro weddings to be really interesting. That's probably making up about 50 to 60% of my business right now. Like, I'm being a small personal chef, I never did weddings. You know, most people do these big 100 person things, and I kind of max out at 20, but now I'm seeing all these like 20 and under weddings at little Airbnbs, and it's so interesting.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it's, you know, we've never really done micro weddings prior to all of this. So it was definitely like a learning curve for us to figure out, you know, kind of mixing the concept of doing like a private dinner with a wedding at the same time. But, you know, it's been a lot of fun because it allows us to like really hyper focus on some of the details that maybe with like a 150 person wedding, you wouldn't really be able to focus on.
Do you find that the clientele is a little different and the expectations are a little different? Because what I'm seeing is when people hire a personal chef for a dinner, it can be formal, but it's still a little more casual. But now I'm getting these people who are maybe even started planning a wedding with like a wedding planner and a like a full-blown huge caterer. And now it seems a little more, I think uptight is the word. Like they're more focused on my china and linens and all that stuff that I didn't have to deal with when I was doing a personal chef. And I didn't know if you've seen that at all with the
No, totally agree. I mean, so before all that, we are obviously like a full service catering company. So we were doing larger events, but you know, usually with the smaller events that we were doing, they're, like you said, they were usually less focused on the nitty gritty of everything and just wanted it to be, you know, a fun night where they could have friends over and enjoy the food and kind of keep it, you know, no white tablecloths or anything crazy like that. But now what we're seeing is they want, you know, a certain type of tablecloth and a certain type of glass and all these different utensils and silverware. And it's, you know, I think they're trying to accomplish that large scale wedding and want all the details and the, you know, the aspects of that, but paring it down to 15 people, 20 people, which is difficult for us to do because, you know, you're the more expensive things get, the smaller your profit margin gets.
Well, and you have a staff. How many people work with you?
So usually we have about 5 people who work with us on a consistent basis. And then we kind of contract out like servers and bartenders and chefs and stuff like that. But through all of this, I've had to lay off 3 of them. So it's now just myself and 2 others, or myself and 1 other, I'm sorry, who we just kind of, you know, have been doing the communication and emails and organizing and stuff like that.
So let's take a step back. How did you get into food? Was this something you were always interested in? Were you growing up interested in food? Did you start working in restaurants at a young age, or how did you find yourself here?
Yeah. So, I mean, my grandfather and his father actually opened up Villeggia's downtown Little Italy. So I quite literally grew up in the apartment above the restaurant for like the first 5 or 6 years of my life. And so, you know, was in the restaurant industry from as far back as I can remember. And then as I got older into like my, you know, preteen years and then through my teens, I started to work in the restaurant doing front of house and then moving into the back house. And I fell in love with it. It was just something, somewhere I felt the most comfortable. I loved food. I loved cooking food. I loved seeing the reactions on the clients' faces when you would bring them the food, all of that stuff. So I think it was kind of destined for me at a young age to go into this industry.
And then did you go to culinary school?
I did. So I went to, graduated from Gilman in Roland Park in 2012. And then I just went straight to the Culinary Institute of America up in New York in Hyde Park, and then did my 2 years there and got my associates. And then I did another 2 years and got my bachelor's in entrepreneurship.
So going for entrepreneurship, did that mean that you knew you wanted to open up your own business? I mean, a lot of people go to school just for culinary and then the entrepreneurship comes later. Did you have that vision?
I mean, not particularly. I think, so the class that I was in, we were the first class where they actually offered the entrepreneurship program, and it just sounded very interesting and very cool. So naturally I wanted to try it, not really knowing that, you know, I was gonna after this open up my own business or even thinking about that. But as I was kind of doing it and I was realizing that, you know, this is something I'm really passionate about, having my own project, being able to see the project from start to finish and then kind of cultivate it throughout the whole thing. Whereas, you know, sometimes when you're working for somebody else, your limitations of your creativity are sometimes, you know, you hit a roof sometimes. Whereas doing it on your own, it's really up to you how much or how little or how creative you can be.
So when and how did you start your business? Did you do it on the side? How long has it been going now?
Yeah. So it's been open officially for about 4 years now. But in culinary school, I would go around, and this is very common for the students up at the CIA. You would go and do like little private chef gigs in the immediate area for different clients or couples or whatever it was. You know, and it's great for them because they live so close to such a, you know, such a high-end culinary school, they can just have their pickings of whoever they want to come cook dinner. So I got into that in my bachelor's degree, so the last 2 years. And I really love that because it combined like my two favorite aspects of cooking. Number one, really being able to like focus on the ingredients and the plating and the quality of everything. And then number two, also being able to interact with the client at the same time and like talking to them about the food, seeing their reactions, you know, starting a conversation where sometimes, at least in my experience, being in the restaurant and being in the back of house, you don't get that kind of client interaction. You're just throwing food out and, you know, hoping that the front of house doesn't come back with a plate, essentially. So that's kind of how I got into the whole idea of wanting to do catering as opposed to opening up like a storefront, because I know with catering, you still get those two aspects together, which was, you know, really exciting for me to figure out that there was something out there that still combined everything I wanted to do and I could do it on my own at the same time.
I think that's the best or worst part of the personal chef and catering thing, depending on your personality, because you're on show. A lot of people ask me about, you know, what are some tips? How do you get started? What do you need to do? And I always let them know, you know, you have to be comfortable. You're in someone's kitchen. You're in their house. Most of them want to interact with you. The bigger parties, I tend to find that I'm more of the help. But when you have a small dinner party, I mean, I did a dinner for two last night and the night before a bachelorette party for six. And both of them were very interactive, asking me questions and stuff. And I know a lot of people aren't comfortable with that. They come up in restaurants where they're in the closed kitchen. Yeah, so you really have to enjoy that part of being on stage and kind of being the entertainer. I think that's what so many people are actually paying for when they hire a personal chef.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the whole, like you were saying, the whole concept of being, especially nowadays, being able to bring a chef into your home and have him or her wear, you know, their chef jacket, their traditional garb, it just kind of feels, It's almost like the same as if you were to have a singer-songwriter or band come into your home and play for you. You know, like they're obviously there to enjoy the music, but at the same time, they're like even more excited to just see you up close and personal in action, doing your thing. And that's one of my favorite parts. I mean, I love talking and I love, like you said, kind of being the show for people. I think that's kind of a great attribute to be able to have and then help those people, you know, experience that.
And then there's the whole thing about cooking lessons. Do you do cooking lessons in person? Is that something you've done before?
Yeah. So before all of this, we partnered with a few different like residential buildings in DC and Northern Virginia, where we would do cooking lessons for the residents of each building, which was great. And I love doing cooking lessons, especially with residents of these buildings, because more often than not, you find that they are, you know, skewing a little bit younger. And so they're always a little bit more apt and willing to kind of chat, have fun, not take anything too seriously, which is a lot of fun for me because it's less of like a lesson for me and more of just me cooking, hanging out with some new friends that I just kind of stumbled across. So that's great. And then, you know, with all of this, we've transitioned into doing virtual cooking classes. So we just use a platform called Crowdcast, and all of the residents can still log on, use the chat. They can bring their video up if they want to. And while it's not the same type of social interaction that I'll prefer, it's still better than, you know, not doing them at all.
Yeah, that's really challenging. I haven't gotten into the virtual cooking classes yet, but I know a lot of people are doing it. We actually have a woman here in Frederick where I live who has it's called the Kitchen Studio, where it was all in person and she's shifted completely to virtual. I mean, that's her whole business. She doesn't go out and do events. So her whole business was totally decimated when this thing happened and had to figure out, you know, how do you still make money? And she's been pretty successful, I think, converting to 100% virtual cooking classes, but you know, it's obviously not the same.
Yeah, no. And I mean, I think there's pros and cons to every situation, to this situation specifically. You know, the pro is that you kind of learn, you're forced to pivot. You're forced to pivot your business. And so you might learn a different avenue that you maybe haven't explored before. That is something you can continue to, you know, go down and explore after all of this is over. The con obviously is that you're just thrown for a whirlwind. You know, it's like you don't really ever know what's going on. You don't have a timeline for when things are going to end. So you just have to kind of keep, you know, chucking through the mud to try to get to the other end.
Were you completely unemployed when COVID hit? Like, did you have a period where you didn't work at all?
Yeah, I mean, so I know, at least for us, it started to really hit us hard in March. And then so March through basically July, we had nothing. Like all of our events were canceled or rescheduled. No one was scheduling anything new, obviously. And then all of the, like, while we were trying to pivot, all of our like cooking classes and all those other kind of like miscellaneous events that we do, the corporate partners had canceled all of those. So we were kind of, you know, I was a little nervous for a little bit. I was like, this is a bit crazy to just go from, you know, was going to seem like a normal, beneficial, profitable year to, you know, within a week, it felt like everything being closed, shut down, canceled, and rescheduled. So you really have to pivot quickly.
And you have overhead. I mean, I don't have a commercial kitchen, but you have a commercial kitchen, correct?
Yes.
So that's a cost you're having to absorb while you don't have any income.
Exactly. So for those few months, it was definitely, you know, and it's hard to expect like landlords and owners and real estate and these like commercial real estate companies to give you a break when they're in the same position you are. You know, so it's like everyone's kind of in this same position. So we all just kind of have to do our best, work together to see what we can kind of make happen to make ends meet. So thankfully, our owners were able to work with us a little bit in terms of like the cost of that during those months where we didn't have anything. But yeah, it was definitely a nail biter kind of going into it because, I mean, especially with, like you said, the commercial kitchen and then the utilities and all the food we had in here. You know, just trying to figure out ways to use it or get rid of it without totally losing all of that kind of money that you spent on it.
So have you found any things that you've started doing because of the COVID situation that you're going to carry on? Like, let's say when we get back to normal, whenever and whatever that is, have you learned anything and have you decided to change your business in any way that you think is going to stick?
I think the biggest thing that we've, or two things that we've really kind of been able to focus on with all of the time that we had to kind of adjust, these virtual cooking classes have been great. I mean, it's great because you can have as many or as little guests as you want. Whereas with in-person cooking classes, sometimes that's limited because of space or ingredients or, you know, whatever it is. But with this, you know, it's still live while you can't, while you maybe not be in that kitchen with them, like showing them step by step, they can still bring up their camera. So it's like, you know, one degree away, I think, from me being there. And it's great that I can do it with, you know, 60, 70, 75 people at a time. Whereas before, I would have never been able to do that with the spaces that, you know, we have. And then the other thing I think that has been great is that we've really been able to focus on our digital presence through all of this and really focusing on doing, you know, really nice food photography and upping our, just our general kind of presence online, because we've realized that, especially now, your digital presence to somebody, your Instagram profile, your Facebook, your website, whatever it is somebody's first impression of your business. And so if they, you know, aren't impressed by it, or the website is unorganized, or your Instagram feed isn't great, or you haven't been active, or whatever it is, they're not even going to email or call you, because they're just, you know, you're just not an option at that point. They're looking for somebody who's a bit more, I guess, to put together and organize. So thankfully, we've been able to really kind of gather ourselves in that aspect and really bump that up. So when this is all over, we're not kind of, you know, we're running behind trying to catch up everything. We're already there, so we can kind of hit the ground running once we're out of this.
Yeah, I've talked about this with other guests. I think you have to look like a legitimate business, right? Because there's also so many side hustlers out there, and I'm not hating on that. I did that myself. But I think when someone's looking to spend potentially hundreds, maybe even thousands of dollars on having someone come in their house, you know, how you present yourself, like you said, that's the first impression. If it looks like you're just some guy who's, you know, making food out of his home kitchen and has maybe never done this professionally and isn't very organized, like, is that the person you want to hire? And I think a little time, money spent in that area goes a long way.
Oh, for sure. And I, you know, speaking to exactly that, I think there are a lot of side hustlers out there that are doing this, especially during this time where they're realizing, okay, I'm laid off, I'm furloughed, whatever it is, let me explore this hobby, or let me, you know, devote some time to this, which is great. But at the same time, you know, like you said, there's clients who are fine with that and kind of looking for a much more casual, looking to keep it as cost effective as possible. And then you have the clients doing the micro weddings where they want somebody who's established, who has a background and a reputation in the field, where they don't have to stress about, you know, if they're kind of taking a gamble.
And I'm going to go back. I've got to find which episode this was, but it was on one of my very first podcasts. It was probably within the top five where I said, you know, right now the economy's good. Everyone's got their hands in the pot. Everyone's doing really well. I said, when the economy collapses, not if, but when, the ones who are going to be left standing are going to be the ones who have a presence and who look professional. And I said this back in like November, December, without any idea that this was coming. And that's exactly what happened. And now all these chefs who were in restaurants are trying to get in the private chef game.
Yeah,
and even
yeah,
though there may be established chefs, because they haven't been doing this, people are finding guys like you and me who are established personal chefs and caterers and stuff. So always trying to stay one or two steps ahead, because you never know what's coming.
Yeah. And that's the most important, you know, I think, especially with all of this, taking this time to even further distance yourself from whoever your competition may be, you know, kind of trying to think of what questions or concerns clients may have and addressing them before they even get to your Instagram or to your website or to your Facebook. So, you know, so you have a better chance, a better idea as to whether or not they're going to submit a lead, whether or not they're going to contact you.
So who's your traditional customer, and how are you finding people? Like, what are you doing that's really great for generating leads?
Yeah. So we recently, well, maybe not recently. So before all of this, we were on Thumbtack. We signed up for Thumbtack, which is a great site. It's a lot like Angie's List, or a site where a consumer can go and look for pretty much anything in terms of different professionals to have come help them do things for them. So we were on Thumbtack, and we've gotten a very decent amount of leads from that. While a lot of the leads can sometimes be you know, I say they're fake. I don't know if they're fake or not, but you know, you get the bad ones with the good ones, and you just hope that the good ones outweigh the bad ones. But at the end of the day, and then the other part would really just be kind of like word of mouth and us being able to kind of market on Instagram and getting to these, you know, these younger generations who are very media savvy and media focused, and showing them like literally showing them pictures of this is what your table could look like, this is what your food could look like, this is what whatever could look like, and kind of, you know, instead of typing it out in an email, just showing them and be like, is this something you're interested in?
Going back to Thumbtack, I mean, that's how I really got started. I mean, I'd love to say that I naturally showed up in SEO results and stuff, but Thumbtack was great 5 years ago. It's just so expensive now. And it, you know, it's like $30 or $40 for a lead that you might not even get if someone sends you an email and says, hey, I'm interested. And then you send them a menu proposal and they say, I'm going another direction. Like you spent $40 that you're never getting back.
No, I mean, last year, I think we were spending close to $800 or $900 a month in Thumbtack leads. You know, and while we would generate actual events from that and actual deposits from that, there were months where, you know, we were in the negative in terms of our like event to spend ratio for Thumbtack. So we, you know, we've dialed back, especially now we've dialed back like our budgets and stuff like that for specifically Thumbtack, just because it can get expensive quickly, especially when clients and consumers who don't really understand that we pay for leads every time they reach out. You know, if they're reaching out just for fun or just because they want to see pricing for something, or they're not really even sure something's happening, but they just want to see who's out there. While that's all well and good, it's still difficult for us because, like you said, we're still shelling out $30, $40, $50, $60 for these leads and nothing comes of it.
And I don't think they love it, but I've talked about this. I put it on the podcast. I've done blog posts, like just the whole kind of pulling back the curtain and letting customers know that we are paying like a crazy fee for that. But I don't like their pricing structure. I used to get a lot more gigs when a customer put out a lead and then you could individually respond. Now they want you to give them this budget money that they're going to allocate and they're going to bid for you. And I've never turned that on in the year and a half they've been doing that. And now I get no jobs from them. It's like, I don't even get a shot anymore. So but I'm getting, you know, direct leads right to my website, which is good. I think, again, with Thumbtack, you can build your profile in there. And I always hope that people will go through and look because my business name's in there and my info, that then they'll maybe jump off their site and just find me naturally. And I
do the same exact thing. And what I found sometimes, which is slightly annoying, is that they will reach out on Thumbtack and then for some reason they don't think I'm going to get the lead through Thumbtack. So then they go to my website as well and submit a lead. I'm like, I wish you would have just done it through my website, because then I wouldn't have to, you know, I've had to spend that money to do it. But that is, you know, for anyone else who's kind of using Thumbtack right now, I don't know if it's a loophole or not, but being able to incorporate as many different kind of like hints in your Thumbtack profile for them just to go to your website, whether it's like to check out your portfolio or whatever it is, you know, it's kind of like a built-in free marketing tool.
Yeah. I don't know if they scan emails. Like, I don't know if they do editing. I know with like Airbnb, like if you put your phone number or email address, like Airbnb website blocks it. I don't know if Thumbtack does that, but when someone contacts me or when I reach out to them, I send them an attachment that has all my info on there. And I'm always kind of hoping that like maybe then they'll bounce over. I'll say like, if you're interested, contact me at perfectlittlebites@gmail.com. And I don't know if Thumbtack like screens that stuff or not. I'd be really interested to know if that works, but Airbnb is very similar. You know, I try and work with Airbnbs to get business, and it's really hard to reach out to an Airbnb account if they don't have a name. Like there's places like I work with the Fingerboard Inn here in Frederick. You can Google Fingerboard Inn and find their website. But if you're just like 805 Smith Street, like it's going to be impossible to find these people because they don't want people not using the Airbnb website.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's hard. And I think that's kind of one of the cons of websites like that is today, you know, they want to make sure everything goes through them because that's how they make the majority of their income and profits. So I think, you know, there's definitely, like we said, there's pros to it. They've put our business in front of more eyes than I could have probably put our business in front of, especially with me not knowing much about SEO or website coding or anything like that. So, you know, I'm still thankful for it, but we're just slowly trying to figure out other ways, I guess, around it without having to spend so much on the service.
Well, that's where I'm hoping to grow Chefs Without Restaurants is kind of like a free version. Like I've said a number of times, I want to be like the free version of Thumbtack because I have people all the time. This morning I got contacted for an event. I can't do it because I'm already working. Like, why am I not sharing that lead with you or someone else? Because I've already got it. And then hopefully you'll share something with me. Like if you can just build a big enough network where you could kind of be free sourcing all this information, let's put these guys out of business. Like they're just a bunch of tech bros in Silicon Valley making money off us. They know nothing about the food business. Thumbtack isn't even a food business. I mean, they just as soon find you a plumber or a lawnmower as a chef. They're not invested in the food industry. So how do we kind of, you know, steal that business away from those guys?
Yeah, no, I mean, that sounds like a great idea, kind of doing like a peer-to-peer type app or website or whatever it is, you know, and even like the Facebook page that you have now, I think is a great space to, you know, post different. I know there are some members who are kind of scattered around the country, but, you know, still, like you said, if we have an event that we're already booked that day or whatever it is, you know, I would much rather try and give that client to someone else I can trust or someone else who I know has a decent reputation. It's just kind of sending them back off into the void, trying to find another catering company.
And then you're still providing a service for this customer. I mean, that's hopefully going to resonate on some level that, wow, he was really great. You know, it's not his problem, but he still found me a chef for the event, you know? So what's your travel radius? How far are you going out for events?
So we go, it's weird because we are based in Baltimore. And so in my head, I was like, oh, we're going to get, you know, I really want to focus on downtown Baltimore. We get no downtown Baltimore leads. We only get DC and Northern Virginia for some reason. You know, I'm kind of assuming it's because naturally it's where the money is in this kind of like immediate area. But, you know, thankfully it's not too far of a drive, but that's kind of where we draw the line. Like Northern Virginia really is as far south as we'll go. And then we'll go up to like the very southern bit of Pennsylvania. And that's really it. Just because, you know, at a point it becomes not really worth a 3-hour drive for whatever, you know, unless the event is a huge dollar event. That's just a lot of time, gas, and money you're spending on whether it's your catering vehicle, your personal vehicle, whatever it is, just to get there. Not even taking consideration the time you'll spend there and then the time it takes to get home, you know.
Yeah, I'm in Frederick, Maryland, and, you know, we have a great food scene. There's some money here. I'm both in the Baltimore and DC market, and I always thought my business was going to do really well here, and I'm in the same boat as you. I'm totally Northern Virginia, DC. You know, for me, I'm a lot closer to DC than you are, and it's worth doing. I've actually changed my information on my website just so it shows better in search results because I've had Frederick, and Frederick was in my logo. And then like 5 years in, I was still doing zero. Like Frederick makes up 5% of my overall business. So I changed like my business location and address and everything to like Alexandria, Virginia to target that area. And someone the other day messaged me and said, did you move? I see that your business says Alexandria. And I was like, no, I just want to make sure that people down there find me a lot easier because a lot of people see Frederick. And even though my marketing says, you know, I'll travel 70, 80 miles, I think they just go with someone more local.
While I
want to grow the local, I've tried so many things and it hasn't really worked out. So I'm just really trying to target in that Metro DC area.
Yeah. I mean, that's the same with us. You know, we were trying for like the first 2 years to do, like we tried, I want to say 6 or 7 different marketing strategies and promotions that we were trying to do to get Baltimore businesses and Baltimore residents, you know, involved in our business. And it just wasn't clicking. And we were seeing, you know, without us even really doing any work or marketing towards DC or Northern Virginia, that's where 80 to 85% of our business was coming from. So it just made sense at one point just to shift, you know, all of our money and effort and time into marketing in that area, because that's where, you know, we're seeing the biggest return.
And I think there's a difference between catering and personal chef, and you do a little both of those. But what I've found is people always look for caterers, but the personal chef thing is still relatively new. And I feel like the people in DC and Northern Virginia are maybe more used to seeing that and hiring them. So they'll look for a personal chef. Whereas like, I don't know, in Frederick, people still don't realize it's a thing. I tell people I started this 10 years ago and they're surprised. Like they've never heard of someone coming into your home and cooking for you. But in DC, you can hire people to do anything for you, I guess.
Yeah, I think it kind of comes with kind of like that big city feel. Like I used to live up in New York and New York City, and you could literally hire anyone to do anything in New York City. So I think that's kind of just the same thing in DC and maybe smaller cities like Frederick, like Baltimore, like Annapolis. They're not, maybe not aware of it, don't really think they need it for whatever reason. So I think it's a benefit, at least for us, that we still can offer, you know, catering, because everybody knows about catering. They know that they kind of know how the process works. But, you know, at the same time, private chefing is kind of where I started and where I kind of fell in love with the whole catering-esque business. And so I still definitely offer that to all of my clients, because it's just a time really for me to relax and decompress and get back to kind of doing what I love the most doing, like you said, parties for two or three, and just really being able to interact with them.
Did you ever work in restaurants like post culinary school when you got out? Did you do a run in restaurants or not?
Yeah. So I worked in Graffiato in DC in Chinatown for a little bit. And I realized that it just wasn't for me. I felt way too disconnected from everything. It felt like nobody, at least for me, it didn't feel like anybody really had a passion for what they were doing there. Like they were just throwing out food to throw out food, and then they were just counting down the time until they were off, which is fine. You know, I totally get that. But if I'm going to spend so much time somewhere, and I already spent so much time in culinary school learning the tricks of the trade and tics and techniques and all that, you know, I want to love what I'm doing, and I want to love where I am and who I'm working with and everything about it. So, you know, while you can't really have your cake and eat it too, I'm doing my best to do both.
Wow, Graffiato is quite a moment in time in the DC culinary scene. And look at how quickly things can change on a dime.
I know.
And, you know, a lot of people who worked within that restaurant group kind of moved on.
Yeah, it got, thankfully I wasn't there when everything was happening. But it's crazy how quickly things can turn around.
I will say one of my favorite things, I don't know if you're ever there for any of the industry nights, but I always thought those were a good time when they brought in chefs. I think I went to like 8 of them, and that was always really fun. I would go just based on the guest chef that they had brought in, and I always seemed to know a lot of people there. But even then, you could see some of the bad behavior that maybe went on at the behind the scenes. It was like a little glimpse into it, but... yeah, I mean, the restaurant scene isn't for everyone. I'm definitely not a restaurant guy. I've actually told people, like, I've never really worked in restaurants. I was more drawn towards catering and then like contract food service. And within contract food service, I did a lot of catering. But that idea of special events as opposed to just the grind of putting up, you know, 500 plates in an evening.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's kind of hard, you know, especially coming from culinary school where there's definitely egos involved. And those who think, you know, the chefs who work in restaurants 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, think that for some reason they're more important and more talented than, you know, a private chef who maybe works 4 days a week, 4 days a week and is actually able to have a social life. You know, I think at least that's something I've kind of experienced in terms of, you know, talking to other chefs and kind of telling them what I do and them not really taking me seriously. But, you know, I don't really let it bother me. I just kind of say, you know, well, you don't really seem super happy what you're doing. And I'm more happy than I could ever be because, you know, number one, I'm running my own business. And number two, I get to do everything I love at the same time. And I'm not doing it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But I think that's one of the biggest things that I've kind of, you know, come across in the 4 years of doing the business in terms of, you know, the perception that caterers and private chefs kind of have in the industry.
Yeah, I've said I started Chefs Without Restaurants because I kind of had a chip on my shoulder. But, you know, I've talked to a lot of people with this whole idea of imposter syndrome because, I mean, my last job, I worked in a retirement community, right? So I wasn't a real chef. You know, I have a 4-year bachelor's in culinary from Johnson & Wales and started cooking in 1992. But like, I'm not a real chef because I cook at a nursing home, you know, and have spent a number of years in catering and had worked at IKEA. But it's like, you get to the point where you just like get over that. It's like, oh, when I worked in that nursing home, I was getting paid really well. I had 4 weeks vacation, a 401k. I had every other weekend off. Like, you're just hating. Like, you're working 80 hours a week at $12 an hour and you hate your life. Like, that's not my problem. And just kind of coming to terms with that. And then the same with the private chef. Like, friends who say, oh, it must be nice to work 2 days a week. It's like, well, if I make in 2 days what you make in five, yeah, it is.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think the only people who really kind of have that outlook are the people who aren't happy with where they are. Because like I on the same hand, I've talked to plenty of chefs who, you know, love their restaurant and love what they're doing and are very supportive and very, you know, communicative with me about what I'm doing. They really truly believe there's something they can learn from me and there's something I can learn from them. So I think it all comes down to, you know, where they are in personally in their life. If they're not happy with where they're at, I mean, it goes for any profession. Their first instinct is to tear somebody else down.
Yeah. And you have different stages in your life. I mean, I'm a little older than you. I have a wife and I have kids who are 8 years old. Like, I want to spend time with them, but I have a lot of friends who are my age who are still unmarried and have no kids and they'll spend all the time there. That's great. I would maybe do that too. If I was my age and had no ties, I would maybe rather hang out at work and hang out with those people. But I think once you have like a family, then you really have to kind of look at where your priorities are and how you balance that.
Yeah, definitely.
So what's next for you? Do you have any big plans with the business, any growth things coming up, or just kind of trying to figure out how to get through this phase of the world right now?
I think right now that's kind of like our priority. You know, like I said, thankfully we've gotten busier and busier as the weeks go on. And we're starting to book more normal sized weddings for 2021. But one thing we have really kind of been wanting to do is kind of do like a ghost kitchen type situation to where, you know, we already have the commercial kitchen space, you know, especially right now with to-go and carry out being so popular. And I think that's a trend that will probably keep up through all of this is people realizing that, you know, you don't have to go to your favorite restaurant to bring your favorite restaurant home, you know? So I think being able to do something like that is what we've been talking about as well. Kind of using our commercial kitchen space to do like Liliana catering, but on a much smaller scale where you can come order it the same day, pick it up and then take it home and, you know, enjoy a nice chef cooked meal.
I think that's genius. We have a couple spaces in town here that are commercial spaces that are shared kitchens. And I think there's going to be some opportunities coming up for some ghost kitchen kind of stuff. It is a little harder when you're sharing the kitchen. You have your own kitchen that's just yours, or do you have to share it with anyone else? Yeah.
No, it's just ours.
So there's a lot of opportunities there to have that.
Yeah.
Have you thought about delivery? And if you did delivery, would you do it yourself or go with a third party? Because I think that's the one thing that everyone's kind of looking at is, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the Grubhubs and the Uber Eats and how much they're cutting into profits. And I think if you are going to get in that model of ghost kitchens and then potentially delivery, like how do you handle that? Is that something you've thought about?
Yeah. So I think we've definitely, at all costs, we don't want to have to use one of those third party platforms just because we've kind of done the math on what we would have to charge per plate, per dish to make any type of money on top of the percentages that they take out for delivery, for tips, for fees, whatever it is. You know, it just wouldn't really be worth it because it came out to be too expensive that we think anybody would really be interested in buying it. So we are trying to find whether it's, you know, hiring a delivery driver or trying to find like a more local delivery service in town to where, you know, we're still totally comfortable paying whatever fee it is, but we're hoping that it's not, you know, the 35% that Uber Eats or Grubhub or DoorDash charges just to come pick up the food. So that's definitely been a big kind of point of contention and just something we really need to think about because delivery, I think, is what people want the most because then they don't really even have to leave their house. So yeah, it's definitely been something we're trying to figure out.
So before we wrap up, do you have anything that you want to share with our guests? Anything we haven't gotten into? I'm going to do a couple like rapid fire questions before we get into that. Is there anything else that we haven't discussed yet?
I don't think so. I mean, just that we are, you know, we're kind of full-fledged into this virtual cooking class thing. And we have some videos up on our website that you can kind of go back and watch and get the recipe for. And then, you know, if you want to have your own little virtual cooking class, go ahead and give us a call or send us an email.
Yeah, I was looking at some of those recipes. They look good. I really like the look of the cauliflower steak that you had done. I mean, that's
one of my favorites.
I do a lot of vegetarian cooking and some vegan cooking. So like looking at things like that, it looks delicious. So I've done a cauliflower steak before, but I think your method looks a little better than what I've done. And I've only done it once. So I might give that one a try.
It was one of my favorites. And I am like the most hardcore meat eater around. And that has totally changed my mind on things. You know, I've never thought So it's actually Gordon Ramsay's recipe that I followed, and I've tweaked it a little bit. But the whole concept is you treat it the same exact way you treat a steak. You know, you're basting it in butter, you're using the herbs, you're searing it, and then you're baking it. And it comes out, you know, incredible. And one cauliflower steak, I never thought it would fill me up, but it is just as filling as like a 12-ounce New York strip would be.
I have all the things in my fridge right now. I might actually make that for lunch. It's some really awesome cultured butter. So I might throw that in. And
yeah, I mean, it's crazy. It really did blow my mind the first time I did it. And now I'm like, I think at points I get a little pushy in terms of wanting my clients to pick it and have it on the menu. I'm like, trust me, even if you don't think you'll like it, you'll like it. Because it's like one of those things that all of the flavors work really well together. And, you know, you can't go wrong with butter and rosemary and salt and pepper on something.
Well, that's where I do some chef's choice courses. I don't know if you do any of that, but I find that there's dishes I really want to serve that people never order when they're on a written menu. So I give myself some leeway. Like I always bring at least one dish that I get to pick. So that's one of those things where I'm going to bring this because I used to have them pick like all the courses. And sometimes they'd pick like weird stuff that doesn't really go well together. And I try and give them some guidance, but now it's just kind of like, nope, you go ahead and pick three courses and I'm going to pick two courses. And everyone's been fine with that. And then I get to bring some really fun, interesting stuff.
Yeah. Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely worth doing if you want to be creative. Cause again, like I got into this also because I wanted to do my food, but then you have these people who still order, they want a crab cake, they want a filet, they want all this stuff. And it's just kind of mundane and it pays the bills, but like, how do I get some of those more interesting dishes out there?
Yeah, for sure.
So do you have any advice to people who are looking to start a catering business or personal chef business? Like what would you do? Some really easy, basic things.
I think the first thing I'll do, and we touched on it already, is just really focus on your Instagram feed and your Facebook profile. I think that is honestly the most important part of a business nowadays. You know, like we were saying, it's what people see first. So it's the same concept as if you were trying to pick a mechanic and you go to all these different mechanics' Instagram feeds and you see one guy's posting, you know, twice a day, always has something going on, and the other guy hasn't posted since 2012. You know, you're always a little bit more eager to go with the person who's more active because it shows that, you know, you have more going on. So even if you don't have any clients right now, I think it's good to still post, you know, pictures of whatever you're cooking yourself for dinner and posting stories of you cooking and just showing people that, you know, this isn't a side hustle. It's something I do professionally. And I'm going to show you that I do it professionally through my Instagram feed, through Facebook, whatever it is.
It's amazing how much you can build the businesses through Instagram. Everyone talks about Instagram. It's like, man, figuring out those algorithms and getting your stuff out there, but it's just content. It's exhausting, right? Like I have between my own personal chef business and now Chefs Without Restaurants, trying to push content from two accounts every day. I'm going to need to hire someone just to do that soon.
And I think another thing that we never really thought about doing, but these past few months we've gotten into, is finding, you know, and with Instagram being, you know, obviously social media over the internet, we've collaborated with a few other food blogs and food Instagram accounts who have a much larger following than we do. But through that collaboration, you know, we send them a recipe, they make a post about the business. And so through that kind of cohesive symbiotic relationship, you're gaining followers, which means you're gaining potential customers as well. So I think that's another thing. Even if you don't have many followers, it's always worth a shot just to DM, you know, 20 or 30 different food accounts, food Instagrams, food blogs that, you know, you're just starting out, you love their page for X, Y, and Z reasons, and you want to see if, you know, you could work together on a recipe.
Yeah, I think that's kind of scary to some people, like if they've never reached out to someone before. And, you know, one of the things is finding the right people, because so many of those influencers charge money too. And I think that's the thing. It's like you reach out to someone and they come back and say, well, it's $500 to do a post. And you're like, what? Like $500 to do, can't you just put a picture on your Instagram? Like it literally costs you nothing. I've had a lot of success working with brands, you know, and talked to some of our guests directly about being brand ambassadors. And a lot of it is like, start tagging every business, right? Mm-hmm. Like I made a corn salad the other day and I posted on my Instagram and I use like tagine seasoning. So like tag them and mention them. And I use this brand of cheese, like tag them and mention them.
For sure.
It might not go anywhere anytime soon, but if you keep doing that, like sooner or later, someone's going to contact you. And then maybe they're going to share it on your page. You know, yeah. I've used General Torbert's grits, and like they've shared dishes on their Instagram page, things like that. And I think that's a good way to also get a lot of success. If you're using a brand, if you're shopping at a store, like tag those businesses.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you have any favorite culinary resources, whether it be cookbooks, TV shows, websites, anything?
Yeah. So, you know, I am a huge fan of cookbooks. I have way too many, and I just, you know, even if it's something I'm not interested in, I buy it because you never know, you know, just paging through, you might find a portion of a recipe that you can use in something else. So I think cookbooks are great, especially nowadays where you have, you know, these world famous restaurants putting out cookbooks. It's kind of your ability to get that point of view of the restaurant, as opposed to trying to like search online for a recipe for X, Y, and Z. You know, you can go in and go into this cookbook and say, oh, this is how they make that, or this is how they make that. And then another thing that I was actually gifted for Christmas last year was a masterclass subscription. And, you know, I really thought going into it is going to be more geared towards home cooks and home chefs. But I'm telling you, I've watched nearly every episode of each culinary instructor. And it's like, I've learned more in those classes than in some of my classes I've learned up at the CIA. I mean, it's crazy how like in depth they go, and not only teaching you like the history of the dish and the history of the ingredients, but different like substitutions you can do in case, you know, you don't have masa or maize or whatever it is to make your tortillas. You know, she'll go in and show you, like I'm talking about Chef Gabriela. She'll go in and show you, you know, you can go to the store and buy this flour and you get a very close replica of it. So it's really helpful for me because those are things I can directly apply to my business, you know, and different dishes I can offer. Like that's where I saw the cauliflower steak recipe was in Gordon Ramsay's cooking class. You know, so I think that has been, it was the biggest surprise for me because I was not expecting at all to learn as much as I was from it.
I love the masterclass. So I also have access to that. And I've done some of them. I've done some of Gordon Ramsay's, but I haven't seen that. So I'll have to go back, and they keep adding every day. I'm currently doing the one on negotiating, which comes from like a hostage negotiator. You know, it's really interesting. Like if you're someone who's going into business or just in life, you know, like I have a contractor who's working with me right now. And it's like, how do you talk to them
and
find some common ground and things like that? So every day I'm watching some masterclass, and it's really great if you can just throw your laptop on your counter while you're cooking. And if it's something you can listen to, I'll put in, you know, Wi-Fi earbuds and just kind of walk around and listen to it. But the cooking ones, Massimo Bottura has been one of my favorites of watching those classes. Great.
And that's like one of the things. It's like you, in no other platform or program will you be able to see, you know, the chef of the best restaurant in the world at one point be that personal and that candid with you about his dishes and his techniques and his preparation about everything. So it's like, you know, it is an expensive subscription, but I think it's worth it because you get that knowledge, those recipes, you know, and it's been really great.
Yeah, I love it. I also did Annie Leibovitz's photography one because I'm big into photography, and just like I then went immediately like deep into like portrait photography with like all my friends and family and stuff like that. It was really great.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Well, I think that's all I've got for you. If you have any anything else you want to share, I'm going to share all of your contact info in the show notes so people know where to find you.
Okay. Yeah, no, that sounds great. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Well, to all our listeners, this has been the Chefs Without Restaurants podcast. As always, you can find us at chefswithoutrestaurants.com.org and on all social media. Thanks so much and have a great week.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Chefs Without Restaurants podcast. And if you're interested in being a guest on the show or sponsoring a show, please let us know. We can be reached at chefswithoutrestaurants@gmail.com. Thanks so much.